Welcome to Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high-profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he'll chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Everyone, welcome to Dishing with Digest. I'm Stephanie Sloan, editorial director, here with Mara Levinsky, senior editor.
Hey, everyone.
Mara, we have even more casting news to report from Days of Our Lives. Lamone Archie and Sal Stowers, who play the super popular duo Eli and Lonnie, will both be leaving the canvas on July 1st. Now, to be clear, this is their choice. The actors explain in an in-depth interview we have in an upcoming issue that they love their time on Days, but it was time to see what else was out there. For Lamone, he's on one of my favorite shows, All American, and like Marcy Miller told us, was unable to stay in a recurring capacity on Days. And Sal also couldn't remain recurring, so we will be saying goodbye to that pair shortly. Now, on the returning side, we're going to see George Del Hoyo back as Orpheus and Brock Kelly as Evan, so expect prison drama aplenty. Now, over at General Hospital, Morgan Fairchild, who we most recently saw on Days as Angelica Devereaux, will visit Port Charles in a very special role.
Yes, she is playing Haven de Havilland, the home shopping host who welcomes Sasha to show off Deception's wares on Home and Heart. So Morgan is perhaps most associated with her many primetime roles. But she began her television career in the early 1970s on Search for Tomorrow, where she had a four-year run as Jennifer. So daytime soaps have been a through line in her career for sure. And she said she was so gratified to have made it through a very intense dialogue-heavy day on the GH set, and that she had so many people coming up to her telling her how impressed they were by how well she handled the material. She really enjoyed working with the Deception gang, including Sophia Mattson, Sasha, and Lynn Herring, Lucy. And when she was done filming, she got to hang out in the dressing room of Lisa LoCicero, who plays Olivia, and is an old friend of hers dating back to when Morgan played Sydney Chase on The City, where Lisa played Jocelyn. Another member of the Home and Heart team that we'll see this coming week is the character of Flora, played by One Life to Live vet Susan Batten, ex-Luna. So Susan has mostly been focused on her writing career in recent years, but she told me that during the pandemic, she really started craving the feeling of connection that comes with being part of an acting company. And so she jumped at the chance to do this guest stint on GH.
Now we're also going to see some big story moments happening next week all across the dial. So on Days, Belle and EJ will make love, which I feel if you had told me that was happening a year ago, I would have been totally shocked. We actually have an item with Martha Madison, who plays Belle in the new issue, and she is very excited about the story, but admits she is quite prepared for some fan backlash, not to mention what will happen if Sammy finds out. On Bold and Beautiful, Quinn will race to try to stop Carter from marrying Paris. On General Hospital, Esme will blackmail Nicholas over the fact that they shared a night of passion. And on Young and the Restless, Victoria is forging ahead with her plans with Ashlyn. But while juicy things may be happening on all the shows, there's a lot of off-camera excitement as well, with the 49th Annual Daytime Emmy Awards scheduled to air tonight live on CBS at 9 o'clock.
Yes, for the first time since the onset of COVID, the awards are going to be fully live and in person, and I'm really excited to see all the glamour of the red carpet. And obviously, I cannot wait to find out which shows and which performers will take home the gold. Having sat in the audience for many Emmys in years past, right next to Stephanie Sloan, I can certainly attest to the fact that there is just such a special and unique energy in the room when the telecast gets underway and those statues start getting handed out. I'm just like preemptively happy for all of the winners and the memories that they're going to make tonight.
Oh, me too. It is always one of the best nights of the year. Now, our guest today is no stranger to the Daytime Emmys. In fact, he is the most nominated actor in Daytime Emmy history. It's Peter Bergman, who plays Jack on Young and the Restless. So let's check in with him to see how he's doing before the big night. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. Nice to see you ladies again. Nice to hear your voices. And it's been a little while.
Yes. It has indeed. We are so excited. And our first podcast with you remains one of our all-time favorites. And at the end, we noted that we barely scratched the surface with you and would definitely need a part two. So we are so
Let's dig a little deeper, shall we?
That's right. We are excited to continue this conversation. And we want to begin, of course, by congratulating you on your latest Daytime Emmy nomination. So to say this is not your first rodeo would be an understatement indeed. It is your 23rd, and you are the most Daytime Emmy nominated actor in history. So first of all, what is your reaction to that remarkable statistic?
I am humbled by it. I mean, really genuinely humbled by it. I just talked to Brighton, one of the actors here, who's also nominated in the supporting actor category. And I said, you know, this is as good as it gets right now. This is all this means. And, you know, this means this much. The people who do what we do decided, yeah, he's one of the better ones. That's a pretty cool thing. That feels great. I like the sound of that. I like the feel of that. And if it goes no farther than this, I feel really good about people deciding, yeah, he's one of the good ones.
Well, we had Jeannie Francis on the podcast recently, and she spoke of her deep admiration for you as a person and as an actor. And she also said how much it intimidated her to see all of your nomination certificates hanging up in your dressing room. So is it just a blur?
It's worth saying, I didn't mean to interrupt, Mara, but it's worth saying, yes, they are hanging up in my dressing room, in the bathroom.
Well, that certainly inflects my question, which is wondering if it's just a blur of decor to you at this point, or if you ever have like an emotional reaction when you see this physical representation of how many years you've found yourself up for this honor.
So I don't get to stop and look at it too often. Separated from the others is the first nomination I ever got from all my children. And there was something quite special about that. I couldn't go to the Emmys that year because I was doing theater. I was doing some Shakespeare at the time. I was doing a production of As You Like It, and I couldn't go to the Emmys. And I think Bob Woods won that year. But when I see them, I sometimes think, is this just a little too busy? And of course, that isn't getting better. That's the busy problem is getting worse. It's a good problem to have.
I was going to say, good problem to have.
Yes.
Now, to be considered one of the good ones, you not only have to be a great actor, but you have to be great at putting together a reel. So how do you approach the task? And what do you think makes a great reel?
So I judge in these things, and what I want to see is someone touch me. I want to see some range, and I want to see connection, real connection. Those are the people I vote for, whether they're crazy and trying to connect with somebody or they're... This year is far and away the strangest reel I ever put together. I do not raise my voice once in the whole thing. I will also say that in the last scene of my reel, I'm asleep.
Wow.
True story. the reel I submitted this year was a show that I did with the amazing Michelle Stafford. And Jack had maybe one too many glasses of wine and had sent out a text to what he thought was Summer and Kyle. And Phyllis is on that text. And she worried and came over to check on him. And he's feeling a little lonely. And before the scenes are over, he blurts out that he never stopped loving her and can't do anything about it. And they were just, well, A, Michelle Stafford is brilliant in these scenes. And it was just so tender and real. It was beautifully written. And I thought, yeah, if any of my friends who never watched the show watch this reel, I'd be comfortable with them seeing it. And in the end, that's the kind of final arbiter, the final tally. If friends of mine who know me well, who just never watched the show that Peter's on, watch that reel, I would be totally comfortable with that. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. So Jason Thompson, who plays your brother Billy, is alongside you, nominated for a lead actor, and you described him to Digest as one of your favorite actors. And I was curious as to what makes him so.
A, he's a genuinely lovely human being. I just like the way he relates to me and everyone else. He was at home here so quickly because of who he is. Everyone embraced him. Everyone welcomed him. He listens. He asks questions. He's involved. And when you ask him questions, you're always surprised by how perfectly honest he's willing to be with you. You know, you ask about how are things at home, how's family, how the kid thing. And sometimes the responses are so personal and real. I think, wow, this guy is pretty evolved. Yeah.
Love that. Now you've told Digest that your wife, Mary Ellen, is going to be calm on Emmy night and you're going to be nervous. So having been up for this award as many times as you have, what are the nerves about for you?
You know, in the end, I really want to win. I am competitive. I do want to win. As you know, I've lost far, far more than I've won. And you'd think I'd get a lot better at that. But as my category approaches, I suddenly think, wait, this could actually happen. Wait, get your thoughts in order, Peter. If this does happen, you have a lot of people you should thank. And I kind of, that's what nerves are. Yeah, yeah. I start thinking, oh, it's self-conscious. And I wish it's my least favorite thing to be. But I get self-conscious. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel that you've perfected your gracious I didn't win face over the years? Or is that always sort of a jarring aspect of being on the losing
end? I have had years that I've had 2 years, two of those years that I thought, if anyone's got a better tape than this, they should win. And it went to somebody I did not expect at all. That happened to me twice. And that probably took, one of them was in Vegas, I remember, and I didn't recover. I wasn't recovering well. And I said, hey, Mary, you need to get me out of here. And we left and got into the kind of a dining area that was for the general thing. And what I didn't get was the news that, oh no, CBS is having a party. Nobody's going to that thing. So Mary Ellen and I kind of sat there alone. And Erica Slezak and her husband, Brian, came running over. God, I shouldn't be telling this story. Oh, God. Came running over and said, Peter, what happened? I said, what? She said, oh, my, I judged your category. That tape knocked me on my butt. Oh, my God. And the winner was probably my third or fourth choice. And I didn't get over it all over again. But I learned from that. I learned from that because I took some of the fun away from Mary Ellen. Mm-hmm. You know, just come on. It's, you know, it's a crapshoot. Every year we're comparing apples and oranges, you know. Eric Martsoff tape is demands things that my tape did not. And he came through and he was absolutely wonderful. And, you know, he wins because he was terrific. Or Jason Thompson is working with someone who makes his work look so good. Of course he's going to win. And you know, it's apples and oranges. And it's a bit of a crapshoot. Be happy you got a nomination and be happy you were invited to the party.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think you suffer a little from, like, you're Peter Bergman? Like, everybody knows you, everyone knows your work, and everyone knows how many times you've been nominated. And I think everyone assumes that you've won more than you have. So do you think possibly that works against you maybe a little, and someone might be watching it thinking, he's so good, but let's give it to someone else. He always wins.
I've heard that theory, and I because I've sat on these panels more than a few times, every one of those nominations I judged in some category, and once you've spent all that time, it's a lot of time. You're putting a lot of time into this, and you want the person with the best reel to win. You really do. I mean, maybe there are some people who watch them all and say, oh, no, this is my favorite person, or he already has too many, or anything like that. After you put in that much time, I'd like to think most of the people are just voting for the person who had the best reel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a mysterious process, I think, every year, you know? It's hard to know what the perfect formula is. I think for a lot of reasons, Peter, you know, because of how acclaimed your work is, the longevity of your career, the significance of the characters that you've played and the material that you've played on both shows that you've been on, you know, your career would be the envy of many an actor. Is there an actor whose career you envy?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I worked with James Mitchell. He was a giant of a guy. You know, very shy. I know, you know, for you guys, it was hard to crack that shell. He was a genuine influence in my life. He came to work so very prepared. He acted with his whole body. He was just wonderful. David Canary was not only a brilliant actor, he was a giant friend to me. When Mary Ellen and I first came out here, and I had that awful feeling that the family's going on without me, this family I love so much in Pine Valley are, you know, going on and having a good time. I get a call from David Canary saying, hey, congratulations on your nomination. We're putting a dinner together. You want to come with us? I did 11 of those. 11 Emmy evenings before the Emmy Awards, I sat with David and Mo Canary and Mary Ellen and sometimes Bob Woods and sometimes Susan Lucci and one year Wayne Gretzky. And we had these just incredibly lovely, meaningful dinners. And their careers are stunning. You know, James's entire dance career, he, you know, what he accomplished going from the dance world to the acting world, very few people pull that off. And then David Canary, I mean, we know about his career and his achievements. Yeah, I admire those people a lot. I always admired Slezak. She's the real deal. You'll never see her force a moment on camera, ever. She finds some organic avenue to get in there, and she is whatever she says she is.
That feeds very nicely into our next set of questions. Now, over the course of your decades in daytime, you've worked closely with many iconic actresses, and we'd love to get your take on a few of them. So we're going to ask you what comes to mind when you think of and hear the following names, the first being Taylor Miller, your first soap wife who played Nina on All My Children.
Taylor Miller, they found her at a modeling agency in New York. She had very little acting experience. She was absolutely beautiful, looked like Princess Grace, and had instincts that she trusted that you fell into her eyes. She was just lovely. And we went through this crazy journey together. We didn't know this was the crest of the daytime wave. We assumed anybody who had a daytime job would show up at malls and 4,000 people would show up after putting out, you know, an 8x11 sign, you know, that Cliff and Nina are going to be here. It was a crazy time. And we held each other's hand and got through it, never crossed any lines. And so our friendship only grew from that. Our trust in each other only grew from that. I came to really, really respect her as an actress too.
Marcy Walker, who played Liza on All My Children, who you worked with at the beginning of her career.
Marcy Walker and I barely got to work together when suddenly her contract was up, ABC had dropped the ball, and off she goes to do Santa Barbara. And the work she did on that show was stunning, just stunning. She and A. Martinez kind of reinvented what a couple is in daytime. I thought they were just magical. And I don't know that I knew Marcy was capable of that much. She was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, New York City's being a little uncooperative today. Well, your sister on All My Children, Linda, was played by Melissa Leo, who went on to win an Academy Award. So what comes to mind about working with her?
Melissa Leo was a knucklehead. She was a little loopy, a little crazy. And incidentally, I still know her. I still run into her from time to time. But she was a wonderful actress on the show, but off camera had all of these voices and these little things. She babysat her niece or nephew, and she would talk to me the way she talked to them. And it was so incredibly inventive and entertaining. And I thought, she's going to do fine. She's going to do well. Well, she did pretty darn well. And the last time Mary Ellen and I were together at a restaurant here in Los Angeles and saw Melissa and said hello, and what we got back could not have been lovelier. She just gave it away how much I meant to her, how nice I was to her, how much she learned there. And she was just, she didn't have to do that. It was really, really lovely.
I love that. What about Ms. Debbie Morgan, who played Angie?
Ms. Debbie Morgan was a complex complex actress in many, many ways. I have her to thank for my job here on Young and the Restless. I'll explain that in a minute. Working with her, though, was this astonishing experience. To the very last minute, you weren't sure if Debbie really knew this scene, really was ready, really knew how she was going to play things. And they said, okay, ready for taping, stand by. 5, 4, 3, 2. And this woman was amazing. It's like I hadn't met her all day. And suddenly for taping, here's Debbie Morgan. Oh my gosh, so real, so earthy, so honest. So yeah, she's a wonderful actress. They had the two of us together on All My Children, and it was a tough time to sell an interracial storyline. And as soon as they got any backlash, ABC kind of backed off from that. It was a disappointment to the two of us, but we kind of got it, you know. It was that, and the audience saw me with Nina and her with Jesse, and they never quite got over that. But I had this audition that I had to go out west for literally the day after my last day on All My Children. And about a week, 2 weeks before, I was sitting with Debbie and I said, I keep getting these calls from the Young and the Restless. And they want me to come out there and replace somebody. She said, wait a second. I watched The Young and the Restless. Are they asking you to audition for Jack Abbott? I said, yeah, that's the name of the role. She said, run, don't walk, run to that role.
Wow, that's amazing.
She said, you want that role. That's a pivotal role on a show. That is, yeah, that's a seminal, pivotal role in a daytime drama. And I went home and told Mary Ellen. And when we called them back and said, yeah, we'll come out and audition for it, I had Debbie Morgan in my ear saying, run.
That's amazing. Well, then moving on to a lady who also had a hand in that, at Young and the Restless, Melody Thomas Scott, who plays Nikki.
Melody Thomas Scott was here the day that I auditioned. I guess they just finished a show. And I came out and did audition scenes with Jess Walton and Jerry Douglas. And I guess they went pretty well. And Melody, who, you know, was finished for the day, and she just went into the booth to see this new guy who they were talking about putting her with a little bit. And she, it turns out, was an All My Children fan. And she, it turns out, had been in an airplane with her husband as her husband, who was executive producer of The Young and the Restless, Ed Scott. And Ed was saying, boy, I don't know what we're going to do. They had tested a few guys for this role, and they didn't think they had what they wanted. And she had a couple of soap magazines in her lap. And there was a picture of me on the cover saying, all my children, let's Peter Bergman go. I guess it was big enough news that I was on the cover of quite a few magazines saying Peter Bergman gets let go. So anyway, she said, that's Jack Abbott, to her husband. He said, well, I'll tell him to call her in, call him in. And sure enough, they called me based on Melody Thomas Scott saying, that's Jack Abbott. How she watched Cliff Warner and decided that's Jack Abbott, I will never fully understand. But Melody Thomas Scott changed my life. Yeah, and she knows I am forever grateful. I write notes to her. I thank her publicly. She changed my life.
It's incredible.
Pretty incredible.
Incredible, isn't it? Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm gonna ask these next two together just because they both just celebrated 40 years playing your on-screen siblings, Beth Maitland Tracy and Eileen Davidson Ashley.
I get emotional talking about it. It's the Abbott family. It does something to me. It's hard to explain. When I'm on the set with those two women, my brother Billy and my kid Kyle, it is a kind of comfort I cannot explain. But I belong there, they belong there, and it just, yeah, it's magical. When we work together, it is not out of the realm of possibilities that someone is going to start a text chain saying that was fun, and somebody else says, I love you guys, my God, I love working with you, and it goes on and on for a few hours. It's a love fest, and those two women were the first ones here. They were the ones that set this whole thing up. They were the ones that built this. They were the ones that were here when they were part of a very important contingent in this cast who brought this show to number one. And it's never left. And we should forever be grateful to those two. They're both wonderful actors. Eileen Davidson and I fight and squabble just the same way that Ashley and Jack do, with tremendous love and annoyance. Beth Maitland is the pure love that you see when you watch the screen. She is the embodiment of selfless, kind love. They're giant people in my life, and I love them.
God, Peter, you're emotional too.
I do.
It's just nice to, like, really, when everyone says we're a family, but to see you and hear you speaking that way, you know that it's true.
Yeah. My Mary Ellen asks me all the time when I'm going to work, so who are you working with today? And when I say Eileen and Beth, she just knows, oh, he's going to have a good day.
That's so great. Now, what about Sharon Case, who plays Sharon, who Jack was married to?
Sharon Case is a great example for everybody that I tell about new people. Sharon Case has her own bent on how she wants the story to go, how she wants things to go. But when you're doing a scene with Sharon Case, and it says in the, I call it the Samuel French, in parenthetical things, you know, Sharon is bothered by this, but covers as best she can. Those kind of things. Sharon Case plays every single point in a scene, unerring. Every single point, a dramatic turning point does not happen that Sharon doesn't play. She is there. Again, she has her own bent on how she wants stories to go, and we all have our own likes and dislikes, but Sharon Case plays everything they write for her.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. What about Jeannie Francis, the aforementioned, who played Genevieve?
Jeannie Francis, it was a joy to have her here. She came in and she's one of the legends of daytime television. You know, we talked about the crest of the wave. If anybody rode the crest of the wave, it was Jeannie Francis. And she was immediately accessible and lovely and talked about her children and her husband and was terrific and a very good kisser. And this, you know, part of my job is kissing all these people. And Judy Francis had a nice kiss.
Good to know. What about Stacey Heiduk, who played Patty and is also now known as Daze's Kristen and Susan?
Yeah, Stacey Heiduk was all of that energy and excitement she brought every single time. You couldn't do a run through with Stacey without her committing totally to it. She was so in the scene. Wait, we're just running lines. No, Stacey doesn't just run lines. Stacey acts this scene every opportunity you give her. And I think she's wonderful on Days of Our Lives.
Mm-hmm. What about Mara West, ex-Diane?
Mara West and I, it was very funny. I was in Vegas at another of the Daytime Emmys. And the then head of CBS Daytime, Barbara Bloom, came up to me and said, pull me aside and said, I'm this close to getting Mara West to come and play Diane opposite you. And I said, I am delighted with that news. I was well aware of the work that she and Michael Park did and that she and everybody else on that show did. So I was delighted with that. She came to Genoa City and worked with absolutely every guy on the show except me. I literally barely worked with her. The little I did, I thoroughly enjoyed it, but I felt robbed. I felt totally robbed because she came here on fire. Yeah, yeah, she's a good actress. And what she does on General Hospital is nothing but stunning.
Mm-hmm. What about Katie McLean, who played Kelly, also known as All My Children's Dixie, and now Daze's Jennifer?
So Katie came in and replaced somebody who's in General Hospital. And it was a very difficult thing. It was mid-story. They threw her into it. And I was very thankful that I'd had a long relationship with Katie going back to All My Children. So I was always an admirer of hers. I always found her so pretty and so smart. And she came and they just... She got crazier and crazier and crazier here, and she wanted to play the part of getting crazy, and we were already halfway there. So she had a very difficult job here and did it brilliantly.
And what about another replacement actress, Gina Tognoni?
Gina Tognoni is a genuinely kind, sincere, lovely person with a whole lot of talent. Gina came in for a role. Gina would be the first person to tell you, I should not be cast in this role. This is not who I naturally am. This is not what I do. And made the role her own. And I encouraged her as best I could. That's the job. I replace somebody too. Every new person that comes in here as a replacement has a great friend in Peter Bergman. And what she turned it into when she went up to get her Emmy Award, I think I was far more excited than her husband. I was just thrilled. She had worked very, very hard for that.
Mm-hmm. Now, we purposely didn't include Michelle Stafford, who plays Phyllis, and Susan Walters, who plays Diane, on that list, because they are so key to your current and very interesting storyline as Jack. But Jack and Phyllis recently split, but tell us how it felt to reteam with Michelle and play out another chapter of that love story.
I don't know how the chemistry thing works. People talk about it, you know. I just know how it feels. And I'm on set with Michelle Stafford, and she's not playing anything like it says on the script. And I'm thinking, I don't know what she's playing. But I respond to it, and we go in a direction they did not intend, they did not plan. And before it's all over, I'm having so much fun because it's a little dangerous. It's a little crazy. And I've been doing this long enough that dangerous and crazy is really exciting. I really like it. And Michelle and I just look good together, I'm told. And it just works. It just works. She's a very talented actress. A more spontaneous actress you are not going to find. She is so in the scene you can't find anybody more quicksilver, spontaneous. If you trigger something in her, she's playing it. She's playing it, and it's fun. We have a fun time working together. And let's get to Susan Walters. Susan Walters. I had eye surgery. My retina collapsed. Oh, it's just terrible. I'm at home. It was the strangest recovery. I'm looking down for 50 minutes of every hour for 7 days. Looking straight down, it was just a terrible recovery time. And in that recovery time, I got a call from Josh Griffith, our head writer, and Danielle Unger, the CBS exec that's in charge of our show. And they said, okay, we want to tell you a couple of things. We are in the process of rebuilding the Abbott family to a kind of prominence that it deserves. And I said, no better news could come my way. I'm thrilled with that. And part of that plan is to bring back somebody that was here in the past. And I'm thinking, who could that be? And I run through all the possibilities and everything. And Susan Walters did not come to mind. And as soon as they told me, I thought, brilliant, brilliant. Got on the cell phone as soon as I was done with them. I still have Susan Walters' number. I call her. She's in Vancouver shooting a show, and she's walking in Bryant Park? Stanley Park in Vancouver. And we had the most fun talking about her returning to the show. Mary Ellen said to me the other day, Susan's actually better than even I remembered her. She has shaken up this show. Her work is so specific. I tell you about Michelle and that Quicksilver. It's free form. It's Susan is so specific. You better know what you're doing in the scene, because Susan has no question about what she's doing in the scene. And everybody has been woken up by that. Everybody. She's so intentional. She's so clear. She's so well rehearsed and ready to work. It's been really fun for me. Really, really fun for me to have Susan back. Oh, this is fun talking about the women. I have some.
You're setting the bar higher.
Yeah. Totally.
I have had so many amazing actresses in my life.
Isn't it so interesting, I think, piggybacking on what you were saying about Susan, how there are just certain pebbles that create just the right ripples in the pond of a show, you know? Yep. And I completely agree with your assessment that it's just been such a shot of adrenaline.
Can I add to that, Mara, that if the three of us were asked, so they're thinking about bringing Diane back. You have probably had the same reaction I did. I think that'll cause ripples. I think that'll shake things up. Certainly Phyllis is going to be thrilled. But the impact she's had, the ripples she's caused have been so much larger than any of us expected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And we three are you know, people who watch soap operas and know how this works.
Right.
Susan surprised all of us. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, Michael Mueller, who plays your Genoa City son, Kyle, told Digest that he was sworn to secrecy about Diane's resurrection and promptly called you to dish about it, which might be one of my favorite stories ever. But what does it mean to you that Michael also returned to the show as part of this story?
Yeah, that was giant, giant news to me. It was a terrible loss, a mistake made and a mistake corrected. And too often we don't get to correct our mistakes. And so getting him back was phenomenal. He's just a giant of a guy. My wife gets mad at me whenever I say this. That boy was raised well. He has smart parents. He had good parenting. He knows when to ask the right questions. He knows when to be silent, when to get involved. He knows he's just a good observer. He's smart and he's talented. And all of those things make him a really, really great addition to the Abbott set. Everyone loves him this way. Talk to the girls about him. Same thing. They all love him. Jason Thompson loves him. Michael Mueller's a very, very special young guy who brings this, still has this wonderful sense of purity to his character that he can't shake. You know, every once in a while he gets ticked off or he needs to manipulate a situation, things like that. And he has character underneath there that he can't walk around. It's a lovely thing. And dishing with him about Susan was fun because she's from Atlanta. He's from Atlanta. Melissa Ordway is from Atlanta. Allison, our new Summer, is from Atlanta. We're getting invaded by Atlanta right now.
Southern charm and Jen was
Southern charm. Damn, it gets me every time.
So I think that the first time Jack and Diane saw each other again, you know, the first when Jack realized she was alive, that was such a hotly anticipated moment and made for such great television. What do you remember about shooting those scenes and actually working with Susan for the first time in a hot minute?
I was thrilled, you know, that this was coming up, and you rehearse it and you go through it and you run lines and you get to that moment where you turn around and there is a person you knew was dead. No question in your mind. She's dead and she's standing there. Hard thing to play as an actor. And I kind of felt like we pulled it off. I kind of felt like oh my God, it was just stunned silence. And then his first thing was anger. Who are you? What do you, what is, this is some kind of ugly joke. What is, you know, and she's, again, she is spot on, very specific. So she gives you something to play with. I always love, one of my favorite things that Susan does is when you finally corner her and corner Diane to say, okay, we're not going to do this anymore. You stop this right now. I know what you're up to. You got to, she apologizes. I say, okay, I accept that apology. Don't do it again. And they cut to her. And then there's this little half a smile that happens in there that the audience sees that sometimes Jack doesn't see. And I just love that. There's mischief in there always. It's always there. She will have a moment of such sincerity and truth. And then there's a little half smirk, you know, I love it.
That's amazing. Now let's talk about the Jack and Phyllis breakup. Do you understand why Jack chose to end things and how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think Jack has tiptoed into this as carefully as he could. He is not ready to have his heart broken. Unlike Phyllis, he didn't get on with it. He didn't get on with his life and start falling in love with other people and everything like that. He's been alone for a very long time and he's been thinking about this forever. And it looks like Phyllis wants to, as carefully as he does, tiptoe into this, whatever this is going to be. And he values the friendship and he values that they still have something and he doesn't want to endanger that. And so he's probably being too careful. They're both being too careful. And they travel to LA together and they come back and suddenly out of nowhere, she's ready to take it, you know, not two steps up, five steps up. Suddenly he's in bed with her and we're... And he gives over to it. I mean, what could be nicer than this? This is great. Jack is, just quote Michelle Stafford. Oh, no, I can't quote Michelle Stafford. He hasn't had anything like this in a long time. Anyway, Jack is thrilled. And Jack thinks, wow, I guess all that patience paid off. We are now to the next step in the biggest way. Wow, this is so cool. And then walks in on the explanation for why that happened. And he realizes, I can't do this. I can't do this. This is too close to hurt. This is, I've had experienced much too much pain. I have always argued Phyllis and Jack never fell out of love. They just, it got to be too painful. They both had to step away from it. And now they stepped back in and it was safe and it was good. And then Jack realizes safe and good. No, this was an opportunity to stick it to Diane. So maybe Jack overreacted, but Jack has been protecting his heart so much that at the first sign that, oh no, this, we're heading back into the old thing. No, I'm not doing this. I can't do this. I can't do this. I hope that played. Maybe it frustrated the audience, but I hope that played. I can't do this. I can't get hurt again. Not always the strongest choice that you could make, but Jack has been through a lot with her, a lot.
Indeed. So if you had your druthers, like, would that be a door that's closed permanently? Or do you think that Jack's pull to Phyllis should always be an underlying reality in his life?
I think it is the greatest love of Jack's life that he will never fully get over, even when he's with someone else. Mm-hmm. I don't think he'll ever get over that. Jack grew up in country club life. He was a Silver Spoon guy. And there were all these girls at the club, and Jack loved him some girls at the club, and they were all terrific, and Diane was one of them. And there were all these, you know, girls who, yeah, Jack, they grew up the same way Jack did. And it was, Phyllis was the absolute opposite. She was like no woman that he was ever with, no girl he ever knew. She was so unique to him, and he was gobsmacked. He was just so taken, and all of the differences that frustrate him, that make him angry as hell at her, are also, there's something about it that touches his heart. She is who she says she is. Jack is so busy sometimes couching his words carefully. She doesn't think to do that once. Doesn't cross her mind. And he loves that. He loves being around that. And she's definitely a candy for the eyes as well. It's wow. I don't think he's ever going to fully get over her. Do I think it's ever going to work out for the two of them? I'm interested to know that too.
Mm-hmm. Time will tell. So the last time you were on the podcast, you talked about the issues you'd had with the original Luann story, which you felt created a sort of implausible dichotomy in your character, who was ruthless and manipulative at work, and then the sweetest, most caring person in his personal life. So your take essentially was that the story required Jack to not be Jack. So over the years, there's been a lot of fan chatter about the erasure of chemo, you know, Jack's son with her. So I'm curious how you felt about that aspect of the story, that Jack was scripted not to be a presence in his adult son's life.
So I probably played as big a role as anyone else in making that happen. It was not my favorite story. There was implausibility issues. The chemo thing was a stretch too far. Then in comes this guy, Philip Moon, who looks nothing like me in any way at all. But there were so many things that were kind of implausible and all that, that if they never mentioned chemo or Luann again, I would have been fine. So it was the same phone call where they told me about Susan Walters, that they said, we're also going back to touch on chemo. And they said, we don't want to make Jack a bad father. I said, you can make me as bad a father as you want. Yeah, I think Jack dropped the ball there. I think Jack just tried and tried. And when he was finally rebuffed the last time by chemo, he said, okay, I'm not going to try anymore. And he stopped trying. Well, he didn't tell his family. He didn't tell anyone. He was ashamed of that. He was not comfortable with that. I was just fine with that. And the writers were very careful but you really tried. Well, yeah, he really tried, but you should never have stopped trying. And so I kind of was able to build that part into what they were writing. that it was a source of shame for Jack that Mr. Family, the guy who's all about family, really let that thing go, really dropped the ball on that. And then, of course, Chemo's dead. And there's no doing anything about it. There's no doing, that chapter is closed, completely closed, until he gets these text messages and finds out eventually that door is not only not closed, that door just blew wide open. And in walks this adorable, lovely Kelsey Wang, who is just has this sparkle about her that she can't hide. Who is, you know, Jack got cut himself out of a life with Lon, a life with Chemo. He is not making this mistake again. So maybe he errs on the side of diving in too quickly, but he dives in. And there's been real payoff for me as an actor to have this girl show up at my house and actually live in the Abbott house. It has brought so much life to this house that I sit in. That's been a fun story turn. She's lovely.
Well, I'm going to detour just for 1 second to clarify that you're on a Zoom with the Abbott living room as your backdrop. And tell us, you were telling us before we started recording about the significance of this set that you recognize.
So anyway, there's a green screen behind me, and the powers that be put a nice picture of the Abbott living room set behind me. And recently we celebrated Eileen and Beth, that's Ashley and Tracy's 40th anniversary on the show. And I was kind of the master of ceremonies, and I was sharing the story that 40 years ago, John Abbott went off to pick up Ashley at college and Tracy at her boarding school where she just graduated, and brought them home to this set that I'm standing in. The ceremony took place in the Abbott set. And I realized, oh my God, it is the actual set from 40 some years ago, and it hasn't changed. And the audience knows that. But what the audience probably hasn't noticed, it's the only set that hasn't changed. It is the only set from that era that is still there, this old, dusty old relic of a set is still there, and I love it. It's old money. It's the Abbotts. They didn't buy that chair. They inherited that chair from, you know, Auntie Mildred.
May she rest in peace.
May she rest in peace. This set has not changed. And I hope it never changes. It's the Abbott living room.
Right. Yeah. I think that says so much for the audience and just kind of speaks to in a bigger picture why soaps just, you know, are so enduring and endearing, is that these are friends, this is family, like this is stuff we recognize. And when it stays the same, you have that really special sense of familiarity with the people in it and just the show itself. So I do
During COVID, of course, we had fewer and fewer tours of the set. Every once in a while, somebody knows somebody and gets a tour of the set. We used to see this quite often. And whenever they did take these tours, they'd look around and there's a set with lights and, wait, that's the Abbott living room. Hi. It always happened. Wait, that's the Abbott living room. Yeah. It's great for visiting audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so neat.
Now, speaking of the legacy of the Abbotts, the death of John Abbott was obviously a pivotal and defining moment in Jack's life and in the life of the whole Abbott family. And sadly, his portrayer, Jerry Douglas, passed away late last year, shortly before his 89th birthday. But just shy of that, you and some of your co-stars got to see him and celebrate and honor him. So tell us about the time you got to spend with him for his birthday.
Jerry Douglas has been a part of my life for a lot of years, and I stayed in touch with him, and I had a lunch with him or a breakfast with him up until Eileen Davidson got in touch with us and said, "Hey, Jerry's got a birthday coming up. Let's do this." And I thought, okay, yeah, I just saw Jerry the other day, but yeah, let's do that. And Jerry's been struggling with his health a bit, and I thought, yeah, he could probably do this. And so Kim, his wife, and Eileen talked about when we would do this, and I thought, yeah, this is fine, this is great. And Jerry showed up and shared with us when he got there that they had had to park far away. It's just the way things worked out with the restaurant. And then they had to walk upstairs to us. And so Jerry, who was pretty frail at the time, was pretty exhausted by the time he got there and walked in the room. And there were windows behind all of us. There were a good eight of us sitting at the table. Laura Lee Bell was there, Christine, and Tracy Bregman, Lauren, and Beth Maitland. Anyway, we were all standing there to welcome him. And there was this bright light behind us that we weren't aware of when Jerry walked in the room. And he explained to us later that when I first walked in, I've been thinking a lot about my life and what it's going to be like when it ends. And suddenly there was this bright white light and all of you were there. And I thought, oh my gosh, what is that? And we thought, oh my God, he thought for a moment he had died and gone to heaven and we were there. It was just fabulous. It was just fabulous. Jerry was a force of nature. He did not hold back. He just loved us all. It was so normal to get a phone call from Jerry Douglas, a message on my voicemail saying, "Hey, it's Jerry. Just watched a scene with you and Eileen. You guys were great. God, that was fantastic. What a good scene. You look great. Talk to you later. Give me a call." Nothing to gain from that. Just wanted to say something nice. A really, really terrific guy. And it turns out Eileen had some prescience, had some ability to see that this might be a last opportunity. How she knew that, I don't know, but he died very shortly after that. It was crazy. Then we all went to a memorial service for him that was touching and wonderful. And there was quite a showing from Y&R. When Jerry died, my life changed here at Y&R. And by that, I mean, when his character died, when John Abbott died, Jack became kind of de facto the head of the family. And I was able to embrace that somewhat. But it didn't feel like an earned thing. It's felt like, well, I'm the head of the family. No, the head of the family's dad. Well, I know he's gone, but still the head of the family's dad. And when Jerry died, I kind of felt like, yeah, I'm now the head of the Abbott family. Mm-hmm. in a way I probably couldn't fully embrace it when it first happened. Yeah, it changed my job here. I am the head of the Abbott family, and I have responsibilities that Jack never had before. He's the head of the Abbott family. Yeah.
Well, Peter, as we come to the end of our second podcast with you, I'm struck again by how remarkable your stories are, what an eloquent storyteller you are, and what a wonderful ambassador you are for our genre. And I'm so grateful that we got to spend this time with you again. Our cup runneth over. But before we let you go, can you tell us what it means to you that when you started your daytime career in 1979, you were a self-described snob about the genre? But you not only fell in love with it, it fell in love with you too. And now over 40 years later, you're still driving story. You're an essential part of the fabric of Y&R, the patriarch of the Abbott family, as we just touched on, and on the precipice of possibly adding a fourth daytime Emmy to your collection.
It's an amazing journey that I have been on. You're right. When I first started on All My Children, I was a theater actor. What am I doing? And I quickly learned, the people who are good on this show are really good. And then I tried to emulate what I saw and found, the real challenge in making this good. But when I started watching, and the best stuff and the stuff that grabs an audience is not shrieking and crying and lifting up the car while they pull your dead child out from under and, you broke my heart. The magic moments, the moments that you and I have been watching for decades now, are the moments where we see her change her mind. We saw it. We were there. He's in the set with her, and he doesn't know she just changed her mind. Those moments are such food for an actor. I don't know where else you get to have that rich an experience on a regular basis. Jack has discoveries that overwhelm him on a semi-regular basis. Where does an actor get to do that? I learned to respect the medium. I learned to respect the people in it. I became a student of daytime. I watched plenty of other, I still do it. I'm in my dressing room. No, I'm not sitting at home waiting for the soaps to come on. But when I'm in my dressing room and there's a monitor in there, I am watching other shows and seeing what other people are doing and what works and what doesn't work to this day. The best people in daytime television are so good, it's unbelievable. There are people here who just started who aren't as good as some of the other actors that are, you know. But all in all, the best people in daytime television are worth emulating, are worth trying to be as good as. And I am really happy to be in that competition to try to be as good as the four other guys that are in my category this year.
I think we can confirm that you are one of the good ones in so many ways. And I mean, as I said earlier, you have now set the bar even higher. So now Mara and I have something else to dine out on with every podcast about how good you were to talk to. So we thank you so much for your time today and just everything and just you being you.
Thank you, ladies. I know how long we three have been in this business, and I am grateful to talk to people who know exactly what I'm talking about all the time. That doesn't happen to me all the time. So I'm very grateful for this fun conversation.
Mm-hmm. And we are too. And best of luck at the Emmys. We will be watching and rooting, and we do hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Peter Bergman for being our guest. If you like this podcast, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to pick up a new issue on sale now and come back next week for another podcast.